Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 87, section 3, which is old single column, page 960. All right, as I commented right at the end of the preceding session, we have this little epilogue section relative to this sort of full formal introduction to the ghost cults before we get into the very, very important element that evolved into that system, dual spiritism. Recall that we're fleshing out in greater detail that ghost cult system that they introduced in the preceding paper, and as they're going to point out here, one of the key aspects of the evolution of that system, it started with just, these initial notions of what humans are apart from the body. Okay, what's the basic sort of not body part of us, right? And it didn't take long for this concept that is basically conceptually on the same plane as humans, even though Ghostland is in some way apart. You're not, in any significant way, really thinking of it as being above what you're doing when you're awake, because remember, Dreamland and Ghostland are thought to be the same thing. It's just in some way not tangible, but kind of here on this conceptual plane. But as it begins to evolve, the fact that we have a vertical nature inside of us begins to get projected out into this scheme of the ghost cult, and you begin to have a concept of a hierarchy developing. In addition, remember, for most of human history, the essence of evolution was believed by all humans, because it's kind of self-evident. In our sophistication, we lost sight of that and had to rediscover it formally in the 19th century. Okay. So they have a concept of evolution that they extend into this ghost land. And so ghosts are going to evolve into spirits. And as they evolve, they're going to go, quote-unquote, upward in concept. Okay. All right, so that's the predicate for how we could end up with kind of bringing this, quote-unquote, worship, or at least a veneration, back into play here relative to the ghost cult. So let's see what they have to say.
Section 3, Ancestor Worship. The advancing ghost cult made ancestor worship inevitable, since it became the connecting link between common ghosts and the higher spirits, the evolving gods. The early gods were simply glorified departed humans.
Okay, see, so that, like I was just saying, you start out with quote-unquote common ghosts, and that sort of, the notion of what's immediately subsequent to death, for an individual. And then, like I said, and the higher spirit. And that's just naturally going to, the more you put a vertical dimension into this scheme, it's you know, these ghosts are going to evolve into spirits and then into something that you're going to think of as more than just a spirit. You're going to want to call it something that's so high it's a god. Yeah. But, you know, not surprising that a lot of our god notions are quite anthropomorphic, right? As they're explaining here, it isn't just sort of, conceptually developed from the bottom up. I mean, there's this whole evolution of the ghost cult that, you know, produced this inescapably up from the humus, the bottom up, and hence anthropomorphic god. So that, you know, when you paint him in glory, you know, he's a bearded guy, right? It's just that's. It can't be any other way. When it's purely an evolutionary phenomenon, it can't be top down. It's going to be purely bottom up. But you know, again, even though the literalness of this ghost evolving into spirits, you know, whatnot thing isn't true, there, you know, it isn't literally a fact. I mean, there's a measure of truth there in our ascension schemes, right? We do ascend subsequent to death through a long evolutionary process, you know, and the revelators even, you know, adopt, you know, some of the terminology. Eventually we graduate from the local universe and we're a first stage spirit, right? So, you know, eventually they actually call us a spirit, you know. You know, instead of calling us ghosts before that, okay, we're Marantia beings, okay. But, you know, it's the basic pattern. See, humans were picking up on the basic kind of inescapably logical pattern that must be. It's just that it's all stuck in a very small concept space because it's all being played off of the dream life, right? Yeah. But nonetheless, it obviously has a potential, despite all of its foolishness, to be getting the minds of humans primed for something like the fifth epical revelation to just say, okay, now just take out your imaginary actors and stages, but keep your basic hierarchical concept and, you know, put the real facts in that in the place of those illusions. Okay, and then just you notice that they start the sentence out there, that first sentence, with the advancing ghost cult, not just sort of the developing ghost cult, say, or something like that. Because they're going to move us towards what I've been reminding us of, you know, quite a bit as we've been studying this. You can take the ghost cult concept to great heights of elaborate, you know, construct, as we have, you know, where you want to use kind of a more significant, meaty word like advancing to describe just how sophisticated it's gotten, as we've gotten all the way to exalting this ghost concept all the way up to the God of, say, Second Isaiah, and then see, in many ways, Jesus is not going to blow that up. He's going to sort of work with that, you know. So Christianity can end up just exalting it all the more from where Second Isaiah left off, and you can end up with this very, very exalted God cult concept, you know, and it's advanced to great lengths, and you know, needs to be respected for the sophistication it has. Right? It's it's not something that one can talk about someone flippantly dismissing. Right? It's a complete lifestyle solution on steroids. There are so many I's that have been dotted and T's that have been crossed, and it's been expanded to an elaborate scope, a vast scope. So, we need to keep that in mind as we, start to kind of take a critical look at these issues. All right.
Ancestor worship was originally more of a fear than a worship, but such beliefs did definitely contribute to the further spread of ghost fear and worship. Devotees of the early ancestor ghost cults even feared to yawn lest a malignant ghost enter their bodies at such a time.
Yes, and obviously the more you exalt this ghost concept, the scarier, yawning gets. because you've got this ever more ominous thing that just might take possession of you. They're reminding you that why we've brought in worship, right? We've got this full package. You've got this individual that you can kind of activate. Like I was saying back when we read that first paper about worship, you can activate a little bit more than just kind of the amorphous reverence energy of the sixth adjutant, because you now have these individuals, not just kind of an amorphous concept. You have an individual that you can venerate, right? That you can talk about as loving, right? I mean, the literalness of the root of the word venerate, right? Venus, it's love, right? And so you've got the quote-unquote love of God, what we call the love of God in the God cult, getting primed here. And it's, like they're saying, it's all predicated on fear. Ancestor worship was originally more of a fear than a worship, but that gives you the fear of the Lord, right? But as they're trying to get us to appreciate, there is so much potential in this. Remember how they pointed out this is the only way to get you to genuine religion is through this ghost cult process. Get evolutionary mortals there. So all of these things are a potential. See them all as a potential. I can't move up the levels of meaning if I don't first get on the zeroth level. If I don't start with fear, I'll never end in love. Right? You start with the foundation of fear, and then you move up. And eventually you get to love. But it's just, you have to set the stage. And it begins by taking that fear and exalting it up the levels of meaning until you have that fear a new thing that we, the literalness of the word revere, right? That's re-fear, fear anew. Right? That's as far as you can lift that fear up as an energy phenomenon in your mind. And then at that point, you need someone to come down from above and help you a little bit to reach even a more definitive hand down and lift you up further, because you're pulling yourself up by the bootstraps process kind of runs out of gas there at reverence. And that's, when they talk in the fear of the Lord section, up there in part four, that's exactly, Jesus says, I find you having gone up from fear through anguish and dread and awe and reverence, and I would lead you up to recognition, realization, appreciation, and love, the other four levels. What we're reading about, is how that all gets started, and how it's, don't think of it as malignant like they were thinking of those ghosts that might get in your yawning mouth as malignant. It's not bad. It's a good beginning, but it's just a beginning. That's the key. You got some?
Well, I'm just thinking, how this isn't very far in the rearview mirror. Because still we'll say, if someone appears badly frightened, they'll say, you look like you've just seen a ghost.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and like I pointed out, that's literally what the word ghost means, that which frightens. See?
Most of us live in cities where there's lots of light, you know. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that long ago when you went out at night, it was dark,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you couldn't see what was out there.
Yeah.
Little kids are still frightened of the dark.
Yeah, we're about to read about that. It's coming up, you know.
Yeah.
In Cameroon and Central African Republic, there are people today that still, believe in the ghost cult and go to the witch doctors. And it hasn't changed a whit.
Yeah, right. I mean, some of those Central African regions, have hardly been touched by even the shadows that the revelations have cast on the planet. You get some of those areas that are, even off the trade route beaten paths, and you get people that are back in very, very original states. Maybe the Melchizedek missionaries, had a slight influence, way back when. But it's very limited. And then, of course, we all know there's, peoples that, thought they were the only people on the planet until, not that long ago. That obviously were, that were completely cut off and in very, very primitive stages. And then, of course, there's also those that they weren't that much cut off, but they're so limited genetically that, they can hardly even think of themselves in clan terms and stuff. I mean, they're just, very, very primitive people. So their God concepts are obviously going to be very limited. Okay. Let's see here. So anything else there? I think we got it all there. Yeah, let's keep going.
The custom of adopting children was to make sure that someone would provide offerings after death for the peace and progress of the soul. The savage lived in fear of the ghosts of his fellows, and spent his spare time planning for the safe conduct of his own ghost after death.
And see, so they throw in, it's like, oh, it was so wonderful when humans became sentimental enough to start adopting children or something. It's like, no, that's not the way it worked. It was purely selfish. Weren't able to have children, or your children are all killed in battle or something or whatever, you need someone to do the rituals. Because your fear of not having the proper rituals performed, it's like, wait a minute, does anyone today make sure in desperate fear that they get a certain ritual right before they die? that stuff is going on in hospital rooms as we speak.
Done it myself.
Yep. Last rites. So they're just reminding you this stuff goes way back, but we progress in spite of ourselves. This whole ghost fear, and your selfish panic, but coincidentally, you get adoption going. And there's fewer kids that are, just left of the carnivores. We progress in spite of ourselves. And obviously, if the ghost cult is so, indispensable a beginning to get to genuine religion, we shouldn't be surprised if there's all kinds of things that coincidentally come into existence because of it, right? It's going to have all kinds of corollary consequences, if it's so central a fact of the evolution on every world. All right.
Most tribes instituted an All Souls Feast at least once a year. The Romans had 12 ghost feasts and accompanying ceremonies each year. Half of the days of the year were dedicated to some sort of ceremony associated with these ancient cults. One Roman emperor tried to reform these practices by reducing the number of feast days to 135 a year.
Ooh, he almost got it down from a half to a third.
I'm sure he meant resistance.
Yeah, oh, you bet.
He's a ghost now.
Yeah. You know, and just think about, you know, you even when you get much better about not having every day being a feast day, notice there's still an energy. It's like, well, we can't just have one day. We need to really make it, you know, a triad of days, right? There has to be All Hallows Eve and All Hallows, and then the day after, you know, which is All Souls Day. You know, so you have, you know, All Saints Eve, you have All Saints Day, and then you have All Souls Day. And, you know, when cultures that initially had their All Souls Day on some, you know, in the summer or whatever, you know, when they get in, you know, in contact with Christianity, all right, you know, where does the, you know, the Day of the Dead shift to in, on the calendar, right? It coincidentally lines up with, right, with All Saints Day and All Souls Day. And so all of this, you know, is, and it just takes on a life of its own, as we've seen in the last few decades with, you know, with kind of the least of the 3 days is in a secular world gets exalted into the greatest of the 3 days. You know, and most people that, you know, spend their whole year anticipating Halloween, you know, don't even know that the next day is All Saints Day and the day after that is All Souls Day. Yeah. Or even why it's what the hollow part of Halloween means, right? I mean, you know, as in hallowed be thy name, right? So, yeah, I mean, you know, the secular just, you know, keeps it going as you know, we know that so much in the past, you know, all of those All Souls Days would have been, you know, a very, yeah, what we would call kind of secular today, you know, phenomenon. You know, it just would have been a very organic, evolutionary phenomenon. You know, in the way you see, you know, the Day of the Dead, you know, celebrated in so many ways. Right? All right, so there's that, and you know, and now kind of back to the point. So, you know, you may not have, you know, thought about that. The fact that everyone had these, you know, something that was effectively All Souls Day, that is tightly tied to ancestor worship. You know, but you know, as I think I maybe even mentioned here recently, I mean, you don't want to lose sight of the fact that, you know, you just have slightly reworked ancestor worship in Christianity with the concept of saints. I mean, saints are pretty darn close to, you know, worshipped. You know, they would at least admit that they venerate the saints. You know, so, I mean, the saints are just, you know, it's just, you know, that whole bit with saints is just ancestor worship reprocessed. You know, and so, of course, all Saints Day is going to be part of the mix there with All Souls Day. Yeah. And, you know, and again, it's just, that's the main thing that remember that they're trying to get us to think about is how there isn't any element of any religion that isn't just a ghost cult when all is said and done. And that this religion of the spirit, this real religion thing that the Urantia Book is talking about is something not really explored. You know, it's been explored, but in a very polluted fashion with all of this ghost cult stuff. You know, it's all, you know, the real God that any human has found is swimming in this bath of the ghost cult. So you haven't really found that God divorced. You know, he hasn't been liberated from the bondage of your of evolutionary religion yet. And the revelation is encouraging us that if you're ready to do that, most people on the planet aren't, but for the handful that are, it's here to tell you it's okay. You can just do that. Just let go of the ghost cult entirely. You know, instead of uploading the God of the exalted ghost cult, download the real God. Go to the find the real God.
And the congregation yawned.
Yes, yes. But it's not going to be the God that you've always, you know, been praying to. The real God is not there to, be coerced into your servant, to be your servant and take care of your material needs. That's not the real God. But obviously, this God that comes comes exalted out of the ghost cult is going to be all about material affairs, because he wells up out of material affairs. He can't be anything but. All right, one final little tidbit they give us here.
The ghost cult was in continuous evolution, as ghosts were envisioned as passing from the incomplete to the higher phase of existence. So did the cult eventually progress to the worship of spirits and even gods. But regardless of varying beliefs in more advanced spirits, all tribes and races once believed in ghosts.
So there again, you see that, sure, there's going to be very, very limited tribes that don't have much internal relationship to the vertical, and so they're not going to, project that out into their ghost cult scheme. And get it hierarchical to any great degree. But everyone is there on the first floor. So everyone, no matter how primitive, has got some sort of ghost cult. And like we were saying a minute ago, you can go, and some people, just all they have is the ground floor still. And that's their religion. But then there's, the leading edge of the Western world that is built a very, very high skyscraper up from that first floor, and we love to play on the penthouse, but no one has taken that leap of faith yet, and just forgot about, put the whole skyscraper behind you, right? Start at the top and work down instead of this edifice that we've been building up from the ground for a million years. You'll even see that what everyone knows about the morphology of a skyscraper being suggestive of something. You'll see that actually comes up here in a little bit. It's not a coincidence. okay, so now, like I said, this is the, as they said, it was in the ghost cult was in continuous evolution. This is the biggie when people evolved dual spiritism. That's when everyone thought that they were, now we're on to reality. Now we've got it going. We're not just delusionally, exalting things anymore. We've found the real stuff.
Section 4, good and bad spirit ghosts. Ghost fear was the fountainhead of all world religion. And for ages, many tribes hung to the old beliefs in one class of ghosts. They taught that man had good luck when the ghost was pleased, but bad when he was angered.
Okay, so again, just restating this foundational fact, like I was saying, ghost fear was the fountainhead of all world religion.
What's that word, fountainhead?
I don't know. And just You know, it means that, you know, it, you know, everything stems from, springs from, this foundational fact.
Kind of like so, almost a, like source.
Yeah, 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 right, yes. Okay. But, you know, like, but, you know, using the fountainhead metaphor, you know, so that, like I was saying, I mean, this is a, you know, this is welling up, and you want to literally recognize that, you know, that you are starting at the ground floor, and everything is just being drawn up in ever more tenuous, exalted fashion from that start, that foundation point. This is an upwelling concept, just as a fountain is upwelling. Okay, and... So it starts out for a long, long time, because it, remember, it's so tied to the, you know, Ghostland is dreamland. You know, it's very, very anthropomorphic, and so to rationalize good luck and bad luck, you know, you just, it's like, well, you have, you know, you just have one flavor of ghosts because you just have one flavor of humans, and you know, but y'all, but you know. That, you know, that one flavor of humans, any individual human, can be very fickle, you know. One day they're pleasant, and the next day they're a snarling tiger, or whatever, right? And, you know, so that, that variability of man, it gets projected into the ghost. And so everyone was very content that... good luck is when the ghosts are in a good mood, and bad luck is when the ghosts are in a bad mood. You know, and it's like all seemed very tidy. You could understand everything that happened to you, right? Right? You know, you've got a whole system. You know, then, and you can take every experience and put it into that system and quote unquote understand it. And so, but eventually, as man gets more a little more sophisticated, as I'll explain more in a minute here, that he's just not satisfied with that scheme, and he's going to get two flavors of non-mortal beings to rationalize things. Okay, so let's see what we have here.
As the cult of ghost fear expanded, there came about the recognition of higher types of spirits, spirits not definitely identifiable with any individual human. They were graduate or glorified ghosts who had progressed beyond the domain of Ghostland to the higher realms of spirit land.
Okay, so you know, literally imagining a whole kind of new land... here, and in this vertical fashion, like we were stressing before. But notice what you've got the shades of there. More than just, you know, exalting them so high that they've evolved so far from where they started that you could lose sight of from whence they came in this scheme. But see, obviously, you know, once you get that transcendent of a notion in your scheme, it doesn't take much imagination to go, well, you know, I wonder if, you suppose there were beings up there already that didn't come up from the bottom? And obviously that sort of a thought, that there might just be, quote-unquote, spirit beings that aren't evolved ghosts, would get some reinforcement the first time beings came down from above, right? You know, at the very least, they told you, you know, we aren't you know, ascended masters, quote unquote, right? You know, the New Age version of what we're talking about here, where you take humans and you quote-unquote ascend them into some being that then subsequently comes down as a benign benefactor. Right? So you've got the beginnings of that, What if there's just another domain? And the fact that you're calling spirit land, see, that even has that, oh, you know, maybe there's two substances, matter and spirit, and there's sort of one land that's made out of spirit stuff and another land that's made out of matter stuff. You have the beginnings of that. Now, humans didn't pick up on that. They could have. And you've got the beginnings of that thought. And again, you have to chuckle about when they say graduate or glorified ghosts. Do you remember how when you're ascending and you know, first you're a first stage spirit and then a second stage spirit, you get up to a certain level and you're a graduate spirit? Mm-hmm. So you even have that term used in the way the revelators describe.
Graduate guides.
And then there's graduate guides and all this sort of stuff, yeah. All right, so again, like I said, the revelation is just kind of taking this basic concept and populating with real objects instead of our imaginary ones. Let's keep going here.
The notion of two kinds of spirit ghosts made slow but sure progress throughout the world. This new dual spiritism did not have to spread from tribe to tribe. It sprang up independently all over the world. In influencing the expanding evolutionary mind, the power of an idea lies not in its reality or reasonableness, but rather in its vividness, in the universality of its ready and simple application.
Okay, so there's two parts to that paragraph. Let's start with the sort of the inline first part of that. As they're saying, and we'll explain why here in a little bit. In a very parallel, independent fashion, sort of every upwelling ghost cult concept in all the different tribes. Every one of them, basically independently, finally exalts it enough where they go, you know, I think what it really is there's two flavors of spirit beings, good ones and bad ones. Rather than just one flavor that, you know, is fickle. Okay? So that's the dual spiritism. You know, and you can eventually get that very abstract, as I'll point out here in a minute. Kind of the way we even sometimes visualize it, you know, there's sort of a white ooze out there and a black ooze out there, and the white ooze can coalesce into a white being, and the black ooze can coalesce into a black being, you know, where we abstract it even from, you know, in this ghost cult sort of individuality thing. And have just, you know, there's badness, you know, that just fills the universe and, you know, sometimes gets inside of you through your ear or something, in the same way it got into your mouth if you yawned. Right? I mean, think about movies you've seen where the black ooze, you know, literally goes in, you know, through some orifice in someone's head or something. Right?
The little devil on your shoulder.
Yeah. Right. And of course, the little devil and the little angel, that's dual spiritism, right? On your shoulders.
This next sentence, though.
Yeah, right. Now, that last half, okay, it's like set the whole ghost cult thing aside. Okay, that's one of the most significant sentences in the entire book.
It's repeated twice. It's in another
place. It's a very, very important thing. If you're going to understand anything that's going on in the world around you today, you've got to understand what it's telling you there. Because otherwise, why humans are moved to believe the things that they believe and do the things they do, you will not be able to figure it out until you get this clear in your head. And it's very difficult for some people to get it in their head because we're post-enlightenment. And we brought in facts and stuff like that. It doesn't change the fact that humans are of a certain animal origin nature where it's not reality that's going to grab you. It's vividness. Right? It's not that still small voice of your reality response. It's the booming, you know, foghorn, right, that clears away the fog with a vivid island of heat in your mind. Okay? The vividness of an idea. See, and not in its reasonableness. See, again, all of that enlightenment, getting reason, you know, as a fundamental part of civilization. No, it doesn't have to be reasonable at all. As long as you can apply it universally. Right? Yeah, it's a panacea. And see, everyone can adopt it, you know, and that. So you're going, well, why would everyone adopt this? This is completely unreasonable. No, it's just the fact that everyone, we can do this. Like, we could impose this on everyone. Boom. It's just so handy. We don't have to try to figure out, it's like, well, we're going to have to modify it a little bit when we apply it there or when we apply it. No, you can just spread it, you know, like peanut butter over everyone. Okay? The universality of its ready and simple application.
Not complicated.
Okay? That's what, so, you know, this is the things that we're going to pass in Congress and impose upon ourselves. Not things that are real and reasonable. No, things that are vivid and universal, you know, and simply applied. Okay? That's what's going on. You know, and all of the effective demagogues know this, right? They'll put forward some elaborate idea and everyone will go, that's ridiculous. That is like divorced from reality and completely unreasonable. It doesn't matter. If it's vivid and pithy, yeah, it will be inescapably captivating. The animals won't be able to resist it. Okay? And sure enough, it'll pass. And it'll blow up civilization. But, you know, but it'll pass anyway.
All the kids are doing
it. Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So how do we apply this with Revelation in terms of, you know, because it has the truth and the you know, and the reality behind it, but how do you take even a part of it, and how do you take it and make it into this, you know, vivid appeal that
yeah, I mean,
forget about the Revelation, yeah. It's maybe too big to do with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you do that with uplifting the concept of God in people's minds in today's world? Because this is the second time they put this in here, and it always caught me in terms of marketing anything. This is like a really interesting concept,
right,
in terms of how to market something. Yeah. Right. So, I always thought,
I mean,
you know,
every
the truth really has to really, be there, you know. I mean, it's not true.
No, every good marketer advertiser knows this, right? I mean,
after a while, as you said, when you preface this,
yeah,
you know, as we become more, you know, feeling like we should do the right thing, you know, you don't want to necessarily lie, so to speak,
no,
to be able to. But
maybe the mother and the universality of it.
Well,
so you know what I'm asking.
Yeah, I do. And see, and I mean, it just reminds you that if you're going to add a little something to the evolutionary process, you have to do it in a pithy, vivid way, right? I mean, and you're not being, you know, a crass marketeer when you do that. You know, if that's really what you feel is your calling, is to go beyond just supplying favorable conditions for you to be grown, but if you think really you were kind of put here to try to really put something out there, you know, and affect the flow of the main evolutionary stream, if you think you can do that and be drab, yeah, you're delusional. Right. No, it has to be pithy and vivid. And it's got to fit into, you know, the evolutionary scheme. You know, especially if you really think you'd like to foster, you know, religious evolution. You know, I mean, you know, they tell you. I mean, basically, the only way we get religion is through an evolutionary process. Okay, you know, in general, there's always exceptions. If one of us can jump out of the evolutionary stream, but you know, it has to be something, you know, that's that's vivid and everyone can easily grab a hold of it and adopt it.
So what is that idea?
Yeah.
The power of that idea. What right. is that idea that yeah. is vivid? I mean,
see, interesting to hear people think. Right, and to think about how tricky that is. How do I make it vivid without making it an ideology? See, because that's basically, you know, we want to add something that your sixth adjutant can grab a hold of. And that means it's no longer appropriately an idea. It's been turned into this false ideal, and it's an ideology.
Well, for instance, it seems to me that, and shut me off if I don't get off on that. It seems to me that, what they said, what the apostles immediately went out, twisted the thing almost immediately. Mm-hmm. They twisted it into an idea that caught on.
Yeah.
The race of Jesus versus,
yeah.
And that seemed to carry a lot more vividness to it, let's say, than everybody's a son of God, and that's the message you're supposed to give, so to speak.
Yeah, just think about the ready and simple application, of the way they went out with their message of Christianity.
It's not an easy answer.
No, we obviously can't really answer this sitting here, but
I just wanted to mention, the revelation holds up Moses as being probably the best example of someone who did
Moses. And he did some very pithy, vivid things, mm-hmm. And he made them all the more vivid by executing anyone who didn't get the point, and stuff. But
today, it'd have to be done completely different than the way Moses did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are we to assume that, in fact, everyone achieved this enlightenment at a particular moment, or is there a point of origin? Was there one single individual who had that idea?
Of dual spiritism, you mean?
Right. And we know that, once a population, 10% of it, achieves an idea, then the entire population, then it spreads, then it's spontaneous.
You see, that's what they're pointing out. See, it didn't spread like that. It didn't spread from tribe to tribe. Like I say, it sprang up independently all over the world because it's like...
So you had multiple points of origin.
Yeah, it's like with biologic evolution. A lot of the reason that scientists can't sort out the fossil record is because they think too linearly.
Right.
Actually, there was many parallel, independent things that produced a certain, type of creature. It wasn't just one line, and through one individual. And again, that's because it's not this magical system that's bubbling up from the bottom. It's a system that's been grabbed from the top and is being influenced upward. It's purposed. That pre-bird animal system has an influence superimposed upon it to evolve birds eventually. And that's touching every point in the system, not just one point in the system. So birds will come into existence. And if a particular way they come into existence peters out, it'll come into existence again independently. And so they're pointing out, you have a similar thing here. When you have, I'll explain that when I get a little bit more of why it's so parallel. Pardon the pun there, of this parallel evolutionary phenomenon, it's going to bubble up, independently all over the place, because even though we aren't talking about something that came into existence directly because of, say, the prince's staff influencing people and sort of lifting people up, each of us as an individual is encircled in the Holy Spirit, is engaged inside, and is lifted up. And so each of us has a potential to be this kind of common purposing influence like was superimposed on the entire biologic evolutionary system, right? So that, mammals can come up multiple times or whatever. Let me just hold off and explain it more until we get a little bit further here. But anyway, just to, you know, to, before we leave it behind, you know, they italicize that word vividness, you know, because it's just so important, you know. And just if you ever are confused why the idea of some politician seems to be captivating people's imagination, it's like, but it's completely unreasonable. I don't understand. It's like, yeah. Because it's not new time religion. It's old time religion, if you will, that, you know, is why it's appealing. It's vivid. It's very vivid. You know, and the people that are just get into droning policy, blah, 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 and they've thought it all through and they've got all these white papers. Boring. It's not vivid. It's not going to succeed. Doesn't matter how appropriate, you know, in an enlightened civilization it is or something. That's irrelevant. Okay.
And once they yawn, it's all over.
If it's vivid, it's going to rule, no matter how unreasonable it is. That's not going to change until we get out of the material comfort era, right? That begins to change when you get into the quest for knowledge and wisdom, but not now, okay?
There's something else that had to have been going on parallel to this, because it indicated this evolutionary religion fostered changes in conduct. People began to conduct themselves rather than just.
Mm-hmm.
So to have dual spirits, that indicates they're reaching some point where there's a separation and an expectation of a steady conduct. You know,
you're jumping ahead. Oh, you gotta wait. We're gonna get there.
Well, it's right here.
No, I mean, yeah. You'll see. Just yeah. Let's read some more, and you'll see. That's exactly right there. What they're gonna bring out. Yeah. So. So go ahead and just go on to the. That's what I want to really flesh out is, you know, why this is happening.
Still later, the imagination of man envisioned the concept of both good and bad supernatural agencies. Some ghosts never evolved to the level of good spirits. The early monospiritism of ghost fear was gradually evolving into a dual spiritism, a new concept of the invisible control of earthly affairs. At last, good luck and bad luck were pictured as having their respective controllers. And of the two classes, the group that brought bad luck were believed to be the more active and numerous.
Okay, so they haven't quite gotten to what Gene was beginning to get at, but notice they're hinting that, you know, at last, you know, they said, it's like, what do you mean at last? Okay, what have humans, you know, what's kind of dawned in humans' minds here that's obviously significant? But the other thing is, you notice how that starts out. Like I said, it doesn't take long and it gets abstracted. Still later, the imagination of man envisioned the concept of both good and bad supernatural agencies. Okay? That, right, so like I said, there's the white scheme and the black scheme, right? The white ooze and the black ooze or whatever, you know? See, and that's what they're getting at. It doesn't take long, and we abstract it away from individuals, and we just think there's this whole, there's this whole self, kind of internally self-consistent good scheme, and there's this whole internally consistent bad scheme, and obviously, as they point out at the end there, what everyone was, from the most ancient of times is worried about is bad luck. And so obviously, now that you've got good and bad spirits, you're always going to be more fixated on the bad spirits, right? So, if you're a Christian, you spend a lot of time talking about demons.
Devil.
And the devil and whatnot. But maybe occasionally you mention angels. Right? That's the scheme. Because it's all fear-based, right? And, you live in fear of what the bad ones are going to do to you. And you just haven't really gotten to the good news yet. Right? It's like that. And again, you go out of religion, you know, and we have a spiritual consciousness. Do we use it, as a goodness detector? No. We use it as an error and evil detector. Right? Soon as we get some spiritual consciousness, we go, oh, that's bad, and that's bad, and that's not perfect, and da 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 da. Right? We start counting how many demons there are, you know, rather than how many angels there are. Okay? That's just the way we work naturally. And so everyone that gets any spiritual consciousness is totally frothed up about all the imperfections of the world. Right? Rather than finding peace, because now they can see that there's goodness in spite of our limited state. They would only use their spiritual consciousness to see the white, you know, rather than tally the black. But don't hold your breath on that one. Okay, the other thing they added in there, noticed again in this whole hierarchy evolving, some ghosts never evolved to the level of good spirits. So you actually start to get this thing where ghosts are just going to be bad. And notice you're also getting that good is above, bad is below. Heaven is good, earth is bad. And all that sort of thinking, see, is creeping in there. Or spirit's good, matter's bad. All the things that are parallel to that way of rationalizing dual spiritism. Okay, so all that stuff, see, the whole, you know, all those different variations are all in play now. But what is this whole at last thing? That there's these respective controllers. So let's read a little bit more here.
When the doctrine of good and bad spirits finally matured, it became the most widespread and persistent of all religious beliefs. This dualism represented a great religio-philosophic advance because it enabled man to account for both good and bad luck, while at the same time believing in supermortal beings who were to some extent consistent in their behavior. The spirits could be counted on to be either good or bad. They were not thought of as being completely temperamental, as the early ghosts of the monospiritism of most primitive religions had been conceived to be. Man was at last able to conceive of supermortal forces that were consistent in behavior, and this was one of the most momentous discoveries of truth in the entire history of the evolution of religion and in the expansion of human philosophy.
Okay. So that's what I was waiting for us to read. You notice the second time they said consistent, they even said man was at last, and he repeated that at last. That's... it's the concept of consistency. That's one of the very foundational budding essences of a philosophic mind. Right? Man is maturing enough that not just a religiosity is manifesting, but the beginnings of a philosophic mind. Okay, even higher, right, than that religiosity. Right, or if you want to think of it in adjutant terms, not just the religious impulse, but above it, the philosophic impulse, the seventh adjutant. Okay? And it's like, you know, this monospiritism is something that just doesn't feel proper about it. I know what it is. It's not consistent. It needs to be consistency. I'm going to demand consistency. See, before, you know, I mean, a primitive individual doesn't demand consistency. You can listen to a political talking head, and you can see how primitive they are, because they don't demand consistency in their thoughts. this sentence says this, and three sentences later, it's the exact opposite. It doesn't bother them at all that it's inconsistent. It should bother you, right? I mean, a consistent falsehood is better than an inconsistent one, right? You're making progress. At least you're getting to that synthetic domain. You aren't just rationalizing the parts. You're beginning to demand that there be a whole within which the parts exist. And it begins to get you into all those things that are synchronized with the sphere of the whole. Right? Things like truth. Right? When they said, one of the most momentous discoveries of truth. See, that truth is tied to wholeness, not parts. Facts about parts. Truth is about that whole. That synthetic whole. And philosophy. You notice that when they first brought it up there, this dualism represented a great religio-philosophic advance. You know, which is the foundational word of the two there? Philosophy. Right? You're beginning to put religion in the sphere of philosophy. So it has the potential to eventually be true religion. That's, as they're pointing out, and it all starts with just that simple little thing where you just have this nagging, it just nags at you, something that really bothers me about this. What is it? Oh, I know what it is. It's not consistent. Well, why do I want it to be consistent? I don't know, but I just know it has to be. See, that's your reality response, pushing in to your consciousness and saying, if it's not consistent, okay, it's not valid. It's got to be consistent. And then the other thing about the religio-philosophic, what that consistency that is the essence of philosophy, or of a philosophic mind, that can get you to eternity and its changelessness. See? And that's what they're hinting at. I mean, these good spirits that are now consistent. See, that could be exalted into some bottom-up concept of a changeless God. Or at the very least, it could be exalted up to the point where, how about if I just flip it from time to eternity, and I automatically have changelessness? Because I now literally have the existential God, and I've left the vicissitudes of time behind. Right? It doesn't say God loves. It says God is love. Right? It's an existential statement. Right? He can't do anything but. Right? He isn't like those mono-spiritism gods that, he's loving today, but tomorrow, he might be hating. It's not like that. Right? It's not that he just loves and you happen to catch him in that mood. No, he is love and couldn't do anything else if he tried. And that's what through that uplifting influence of the consistency of philosophy, you can make that leap of faith to the actual eternity existential fact of the real God. You got something?
Yeah, I do.
Yep.
So how does that fit in with spontaneity in terms of, remember when they talk about the materialistic universe, et cetera, and it would be, if it weren't, it's conditioned by the fact that there is, that we all have choices and mm-hmm. make choices mm-hmm. and have spontaneous mm-hmm. Actions that are part of the supreme, so to speak, that make things change and happen.
Mm-hmm.
How does that differ than consistency, or is that part of the consistency? Do you know what I mean?
There's all of that free will. Remember, spontaneous literally means of free will. Mm-hmm. So, all of that spontaneity we have to learn is inescapably in a context. We have to put all of that free will in cooperative subordination, right, to, you know, and from our media perspective, a finite frame, but you can take it all the way up, you know, when you talk about being in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity, right, that existential whole that parts like the Universal Father are within. I mean, that, all of that free will is in a context, you know, and it, you know, and it's, in a way you can think of it, it's bounded by that. When a human goes out of that bound, to iniquity, so you don't really go outside of the bounds. They just cease to exist because there isn't anything outside of those bounds. Okay, so it's in...
Maybe I'm misunderstanding between consistency and predictability.
Right. Well, no, okay, no. So just, you know, there's this spontaneity, there's this originality, but it all has a context. I can't... it's impossible for me to exercise my free will, really, in defiance of the fact of the Supreme.
Yeah, or the, what's the God of potentiality? And then there was just like,
right, you just,
so much
you can... Yeah, I mean, you know, if you take it all the way, you know, God, you know, when you talk about the Universal Father, God can't make square circles. Doesn't matter how much free will he has, he can't make a square circle. Right, there's a certain frame within which you exist, and you know, it is innately limiting. And you know, the things that Lucifer can't recognize, you know, the thing that Lucifer couldn't recognize is that, you know, it's like, well, you're not going to put me in that limiting box. Okay, well, it appears to be a limiting box, but it isn't really. I mean, you know, like for instance, you don't fully liberate your free will, your personality, until you put it in the frame of absolute law on the Isle of Paradise. See, it's counterintuitive to a primitive bottom-up animal origin mind. It's like, well, wait a minute, if I'm locked in an absolute law box, aren't I in absolute bondage? No, that then and only then are you really free. Thy liberty in law. Right, I mean, humans know that, you know, but and they literally put it in song because it's not what you initially think is the case. Especially since we've been taught by Kalagashia the principles of the rebellion, which is the opposite of that. You know, thy liberty in license. No, it's thy liberty in law. That only then are you really free. Only then will you discover that you can act. It, you know, to the infinity of spontaneity, and you never slam your head against a wall or a ceiling. You discover infinity. Those bounds there that appear to be stopping you are to guide you into infinity. You know, it actually allows your full liberty.
So the individual creativity, you know, as we all know, things go on in life and you say, well, this has got to be like this, and all of a sudden something happens that you have no idea out of left field that takes that consistent thing, you know, when I'm looking at it on a lowly human level, and then says, oops, you know, some spontaneity changed it, so to speak. So, but when you're not saying that the consistency of God, you know, it also includes that particular spontaneity.
There's also the subtlety of don't think of consistency as a synonym for uniformity.
Okay.
Consistency is a higher concept. It's a concept that is transcendent of uniformity. How you're fundamentally consistent is relative to truth. You know, when you're going along like you're saying, and you come up against a roadblock, you go, well, I can't be consistent anymore. I've got to change. It's like, you can't be monotone anymore. Yeah, okay. But see, you can go forward along the same thread of truth, but you've got to bring a new idea down from that thread of truth, right? The idea has to change.
No, that's definitely true.
Yeah.
See, all the time.
Yeah. See, and that's an ideologue thinks otherwise. It's like, no, I'm just going to get a bigger hammer and pound my idea into the square hole, right? It's like, no, you need to reform your idea.
That's why we're given a mind, right?
Mm-hmm. Being able to adapt.
When Jesus talked to that guy, what's his name? Fortune up on the hill.
Yeah.
You're not doing any good sitting here. You have a mind and a body.
Jesus had to change his ideas over and over and over again because the Supreme didn't allow for his initial scheme, right? But he was consistent to the truth. Right? There's a consistent thread of truth through all of his ideas.
Yeah. Can you compare it to, like, maybe music theory? So that the laws of music theory, if you stay within that, then everything's hunky-dory.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go outside of that, then it's
chaos. It's chaos, right. It's cacophony instead of harmony. Yeah. Right, and it's just, there's laws of harmony. They don't really limit you, those laws. No, they liberate you.
Exactly, that's...
Right.
You can create and
that the,
arrange in different ways.
A mature mind discovers this. See, that you know, Lucifer was an immature mind. It's hard to imagine. He's so much more brilliant than we are, okay? But see, he's fundamentally immature. You know, he couldn't see that. He saw these laws as ultimately limiting. No, they're ultimately liberating, not limiting. The truth will set you free, right? So back to this here. Let's see. So like I was stressing, it's, you know, notice when the book uses the word consistent or consistency, right? They're reminding you of that foundation of a philosophic recognition that you can bring into your understanding of that passage. Very important foundational concept. Let's see here. Did I get everything there? I think I've brought out everything else. Just the way it ended. You know, see, not only is it the entire history of the evolution of religion and in the expansion of human philosophy. See, what we're seeing is to really go to more sophisticated religious ends, you have to bring in philosophy. That's why, you know, when you go to papers 99 through 103, you're going, oh, I want to read the religion, the so-called religion papers. And you're reading, it's like, why does the word philosophy occur so many times in these papers? Right. Because they're trying to, illuminate true religion, right? Which only exists in the sphere of true philosophy. All right.
Evolutionary religion has, however, paid a terrible price for the concept of dual spiritism. Man's early philosophy was able to reconcile spirit constancy with the vicissitudes of temporal fortune only by postulating two kinds of spirits, one good and the other bad. And while this belief did enable man to reconcile the variables of chance with the concept of unchanging supermortal forces, this doctrine has ever since made it difficult for religionists to conceive of cosmic unity. The gods of evolutionary religion have generally been opposed by the forces of darkness.
Generally, yeah. Why is that an understatement? What began as a definite positive step, if it's all good things taken to extreme, become bad. You know, see, in a literal sense, how religionists, you know, can't conceive of cosmic unity. You take this too far, and it's fundamentally disruptive. It's bad, right? Unity's, you know, the proper conception of unity is not possible. You can't get to the real spirit domain, which is pure unity. So it has that downside eventually. It's an important stepping stone, but needs to be left behind eventually. And notice the little thing what we're talking about, John. Notice how they said man's early philosophy was able to reconcile spirit constancy in contrast to consistency, right? Yeah, see, and there's that, just like I was saying, I mean, this philosophic consistency is transcendent of mere constancy of parts, okay? Because it's of truth, you know, not merely of fact. Changing facts can still be consistent, even though they're not constant. Okay, that's the difference in the terms. So that that disruption. You know, and like I was just wanted to say one more thing about that. Remember that what it ties into this uniformity thing. When humans are reading the Urantia book and see the word unity, they're going to think uniformity because we think in such material terms. Uniform matter. We call ideal. Right, that's that material idealism. Or let's do a spiritual thing. Let's all pray at the same time. To demonstrate our unity. It's like no, that's uniformity. If you all pray at the same time, parts all doing the same thing uniformly is not unity. Yeah, but it's difficult because we can't see spirit stuff, and so. We try to make matter do it, and it's like uniform matter is as close as we can get to the unity that is spirit. So, you have to challenge yourself. There's a unity fact that you can't see. The parts that you can see, the individuality is in the midst, is immersed in that unity fact. And there's a super additive consequence of the relationship between the two. That individuality comes into association. Yeah, that associativity that is the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two. So keep that in mind always, even a lot of times in the book, they won't be pedantic about this, they might be speaking of unity where it seems like it's a quality of the parts, but don't misinterpret that passage. What it means is those parts are in relationship to unity and hence have a coordinate manifestation. Okay? They don't literally embody the unity. They're in touch with it. And manifest an associativity that demonstrates the fact that they're in touch with unity. Parts don't self-associate. They have to be sparked by being engaged by unity to associate. So just start to challenge yourself about the word unity, to think about it a little more precisely. Did we get everything there? I think so. Yeah, let's keep going here. Oh, other than just, that bit about the, like I said, you abstract it into agencies, like they're saying, they're the forces, see, of darkness, right? It's not just dark individuals, it turns into this, ubiquitous force, right? Yeah, and that just, sure, that's more sophisticated, it's more abstract, but it's going to be all the more difficult to leave it behind because you've made it so fancy with this abstraction. And that's why we can't leave it behind. We're just really stuck in it now because we literally think of it as something that we are inescapably bathing in, right? And it's like, I can go around a dark individual, but how am I going to go around a ubiquitous darkness? You know, you've trapped yourself in your scheme.
The tragedy of all this lies in the fact that when these ideas were taking root in the primitive mind of man, there really were no bad or disharmonious spirits in all the world. Such an unfortunate situation did not develop until after the Caligastic Rebellion and only persisted until Pentecost. The concept of good and evil as cosmic coordinates is, even in the 20th century, very much alive in human philosophy. Most of the world's religions still carry this cultural birthmark of the long-gone days of the emerging ghost cults.
And just see, you know, they didn't bother to put quotes around that, but cosmic quote-unquote coordinates, right, as if you could coordinate good and evil. Right? See, like I was saying, the only reason that the individualities become coordinate is because they're engaged to a singular unity, not some sort of quote-unquote coordinated dual unity disunity or something. I mean, it's just, you know, it's ridiculous. It's not logical.
It reminds me of thesis, antithesis, mm-hmm. synthesis.
Yes, see, right, and that fallacy of Hegelian dialectic like that, if you want to call it that, of thesis plus antithesis, superadditively produces synthesis. No, something plus nothing doesn't produce anything. To have a superadditive consequence, you have to have two somethings, not a something and a not something. It's not logical. But it all stems from this dual spiritism. See, again, you're very correct in recognizing that.
There's still a belief that you can become, into league with the dark forces
mm-hmm.
and exert great power. And when someone accuses someone of being a Nazi or Hitler, mm-hmm. That's kind of what they're referring to. You're in league with dark forces.
You didn't cover your mouth when you yawned, and the black ooze has filled you. Yeah, that's right.
Good and bad spirits don't mean there's not good and bad people.
No, it doesn't, right. Yeah, to that point, though, like they're pointing out, well, prior to Pentecost, there literally were rebel beings. But see, again, your first thought is, oh, that's probably why we got dual spiritism and everyone just picked up on it, because they were being engaged by rebel midwares and non-rebel midwares. And it's like, no, it has nothing to do with that, like they're pointing out. It all came just because of that, your encirclement of the Holy Spirit eventually demanded consistency, Like we're pointing out, it's kind of a rudimentary consistency because it's kind of just this constancy. But nonetheless, it's coming from within, not from without. But obviously, as soon as you had, rebel midwares engaging people, many strange things happened in those days. I mean, do we need any further proof that dual spiritism is valid? I mean, this would just, this again, seal the deal. That got completely inculcated into religious doctrine. So, I mean, you can't convince anyone now that there isn't good and bad spirits. I mean, it's right there in the New Testament. Jesus drove out the demon, right? It's like, yeah, because there were rebel secondary midwares back then, but not anymore. They were all taken off the planet.
Yeah, the rebellion confused things, but it didn't change the need for logical consistency.
No. So, yeah, so anyway, they're just, you know, they threw in that paragraph just to dispel that notion. It's like, you know, don't think that this dual spiritism comes from the rebellion and the default. No. It's kind of, it's just an inescapable thing in the evolutionary process as you will conceive of this. And it takes you a step, but if you take it too far, all good things taken to extreme become bad. All right, let's get a little bit more here.
Section 5, the advancing ghost cult. Primitive man viewed the spirits and ghosts as having almost unlimited rights, but no duties. The spirits were thought to regard man as having manifold duties, but no rights. The spirits were believed to look down upon man as constantly failing in the discharge of his spiritual duties. It was the general belief of mankind that ghosts levied a continuous tribute of service as the price of non-interference in human affairs, and the least mischance was laid to ghost activities. Early humans were so afraid they might overlook some honor due the gods that, after they had sacrificed to all known spirits, they did another turn to the unknown gods, just to be thoroughly safe.
You know, just to dot the final I on that insurance policy. Okay, so this section culminates in another very, very important set of things. We may not get that far tonight, but it's. They're building towards that in just the way they open here. You know, bringing in this concept of duty. Not to mention, think about how, you know, the gods are always betrayed. You know, they don't have any duties. They just lounge around until first, you know, they get some whim and they want to poke humans, you know. You know, we even bring that into, you know, the whole concept of you know, mystics or spiritual, you know, people and stuff. You know, that they have unlimited rights and no duties. Everyone should just, you know, serve them, wait on them hand and foot. And the mores systems don't apply to them. You know, they're the exception to the mores system. See, that's all stemming from, you know, you created this whole notion in spirit land, and then you kind of brought it back down here. You know, if this person is really tied to spirit land, so he's got that whole unlimited rights, no duties thing. You know, and I'll just accept that. You know, because I'm so fearful, I'll let the shaman have unlimited rights and no duties if he assures me that. If I just do whatever he says, adopt his endless oppressive duties, it's my insurance policy, and I'm going to get to spirit land eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it just goes on and on. You know, the pastor gets his house for free. You know, the congregation buys his house or whatever. You know, I mean, just, you know, you can go on, on and on and on. All right, you know, so they, you know, but their spirits are looking down. Remember, we got this definite hierarchy now. You know, notice all the projection with that guilt. You know, you have all this guilt and you're projecting that. And so, you know, into this system so that, you know, they're looking down upon man as constantly failing in the discharge of his spiritual duties, you know. And that's all just being generated by this, you know, the internal guilt being projected into this concept. You know, there's just no end, like this, you know, this continuous tribute, like they're saying, that's levied on you. And again, notice the fixation on the negative. And the least mischance was laid to ghost activities. You know? So every unpleasant thing, you know you slipped in your duties somewhere, and the spirits poked you because of it, or eventually God poked you because of it. It's like, well, what about the pleasant things? Not initially. You're not thinking about, you know, it's all negative to begin with. All right.
And now the simple ghost cult is followed by the practices of the more advanced and relatively complex spirit ghost cult. The service and worship of the higher spirits as they evolved in man's primitive imagination. Religious ceremonial must keep pace with spirit evolution and progress. The expanded cult was but the art of self-maintenance, practiced in relation to belief in supernatural beings. Self-adjustment to spirit environment. Industrial and military organizations were adjustments to natural and social environments, and as marriage arose to meet the demand of bisexuality, so did religious organization evolve in response to the belief in higher spirit forces in spiritual beings. Religion represents man's adjustment to his illusions of the mystery of chance. Spirit fear and subsequent worship were adopted as insurance against misfortune as prosperity policies.
Prosperity. Who doesn't want that?
Religion is like your insurance broker?
Yeah, yes, it's all just, you know, like they've been stressing. Just notice how they're laying this out. All this stuff that you think of as spiritual forces and spiritual beings and your spirit environment and all this, like they're saying, see, all of this is just this illusory domain that everyone is talking about. And if you've finally gotten to the point where that's not adequate for you, you demand a more logical spirit environment. You have to swallow hard and recognize you're going to have to just get the big eraser out, because everything is this scheme. Right? The whole way the apostles interpreted what Jesus said and did is in this scheme. Everything is in this scheme. Right? I mean, that's the thing that, you know, why Jesus was constantly pulling his hair out, trying to get them to somehow not interpret everything he said, you know, in this very material-based ghost cult system. And he never could get them to think outside of it. It was just hopeless.
You said earlier, that's an evolutionary process headed towards a truth.
Mm-hmm.
There are spirit beings.
Yes.
There is truth there, but...
Yes, and Jesus was like trying to do what I was saying, you know, a ways back by that. He's like, okay, you've gone up as high as you can by your bootstraps. Okay, I want to get you to actually, now from that point, you can jump far enough where you can rotate and plant your feet in eternity now, instead of in this fancy illusory temporal construct that you've built up. I want to reveal to you that God is your spiritual father, right? Not your fancy material father. He doesn't have any relationship to your material affairs, you know, and your religious actions aren't to try to coerce him to help you with your material affairs. He's not your material father. He's your spiritual father. And he was trying to get people to take that leap of genuine faith across that divide and plant their feet in eternity instead of time. Let's see here. What else do we have there? Let's see. I know there were some other things I wanted to say there. The little tongue-in-cheek. Religious ceremonial must keep pace with spirit evolution in progress. Right. The more elaborate your illusory scheme, right, the more complicated all these rituals and stuff become.
However, at the same time, you know, when they go over all the different kinds of angelic,
mm-hmm.
you know, classes of angels there are here, mm-hmm. working on hell, agriculture, I think.
Right.
There is spiritual, or, you know, or beings of the mother that are fostering material growth, so to speak. Right?
Sure.
Yeah.
But
it's not God necessarily.
Right. But they also tell you that those angels don't respond to your prayers.
Oh, well, right.
Okay. Yeah, see, so, yeah, sure, they're...
No, but your goal is to try and respond to them. Try and be in sync with...
Right.
You can.
Right. Right. Again, it's just, you know, the whole point is that religion is not coercion of spirit beings to help you with material affairs. That's not what religion is about. It's about your inner life, not your outer life.
When God and man go into partnership, great things can and do happen. That's a different kind of partnership, right?
Yeah, in the inner life. When you go into partnership in the inner life, you know, as opposed to thinking about that, you know, as, you know, like when two people form a, you know, a literal business partnership, you know. I mean, he's...
Funny story. Paul and I started social season, went into the lawyer. He said, okay, who's going to be your stockholders? And we said, well, me, Mo, and God. He said, you can't have God as a stockholder.
Right, right. He should have said, because God is in the inner life, and this and celestial seasons is in the outer life. Right, but you know, but again, to the point. See, I mean, that's what humans have always thought of as God. You know, that they want to do what they're, you know, what is expected of them, so that God will be in partnership with them in their outer life. And Jesus came to say, no, that's not what God is about. It's not about your outer life. We're here first, maybe. Yep.
And then religion means link back to eternity anyway.
Right. That bound back, you know, that is the literalness of the word, you know, religion. Yeah, bound back to eternity.
So, in your inner life, seek first the kingdom of heaven. So plant your feet up there first,
mm-hmm.
and get that understanding and that balance and that, you know, do that first.
That's stability.
Yeah. And then the fruits can flow out into the material.
Right.
Based on that.
Right. Yeah. Based on a genuine inner life. Right, I mean, as you move up the cosmic levels, as you go inward in the psychic circles, there are more and more effective material fruits that manifest. But don't make the mistake of thinking because someone has material success that indicates that they're a second circler or something. No. All right, let's see. There's more things here. I think we got everything there. Yeah, keep on.
The savage visualizes the good spirits as going about their business, requiring little from human beings. It is the bad ghosts and spirits who must be kept in good humor. Accordingly, primitive peoples paid more attention to their malevolent ghosts than to their benign spirits.
Right. Everyone pays more attention to the devil than they do to God. It's sad to record. you can coalesce it, you know, from the menagerie into two individuals, but it's still, you'll still give preference because of your animal origin nature to your fear of the devil than of your love of God.
So is that why, you know, when they talk about, I think it's paper 195, they say, with all the evil in the world, what, with all the good, you know, it's the, what do they say, the black against the white background, and why do we spend so much time focusing on that?
On the handful of black dots, yes.
Of our animal origin, and this, mm-hmm. all of this, it's just an evolutionary where we're at?
Because, you know, our fear makes the black more vivid.
Yep. Not more entertaining.
Well, I mean, there's people make billions of dollars making horror movies, and it's apparently entertainment. You know, so many people think.
Stimulating.
Yeah, Right, it's all very, you know, it's that you know, we, it's like when the energies in your mind are coursing that are predicated on fear, you go, oh, I feel alive. And that's why I like to go to those horror movies. You know, my life is such a dead worker drawn life, you know, but I go to a horror movie and I feel like I'm alive again. Wow, that's pretty primitive. I could just poke you with a sharp stick. I could hook a battery up to you. right, it's pretty silly. But it's all because we are so predicated on fear. All right.
Before you go on. Said that made that sense. And is that connected to genetics? Fear? Or is it just an animal?
Well, I mean, it's just, it's animal origin fear. It's animal fear. I mean, it's just inescapable.
And you can overcome that.
You can temper it to a degree. You can never completely eliminate it because in this life, perforce, you serve two masters. There's an inescapable fear generator inside of you, but it doesn't have to be the final word.
Okay.
Yeah. And it starts by having an alternative voice, and then working on habitually giving preference to that alternative voice.
Is that the piece which passes all understanding in a way?
Right, and the more that you are predicated on that alternative voice, and don't have this, what people think is, well, inescapably, you're going to have a fear response there, and you don't, so you must be crazy. I mean, because only a crazy person wouldn't have a fear response there. You're beside yourself. And of course, to agree, so you are beside yourself. That's why we have an hourglass analogy instead of a cylinder, right? The upper domain is beside the lower domain, right? There is a truth to that Jesus was beside himself. He was standing on eternity, not on time. So, but his fingers were still in time, and he can't help but have things influence him as an animal origin creature, but they're not the final word. Yeah.
And it's like there's a different perspective. Like when you're looking out of a third floor window down at something that's going on in the park, see it from that perspective, nice and warm inside, comfortable, safe. But if you were down on the really close, out in the elements, potentially in danger, looking at the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, your perspective matters. The way you're going to be informed about what you're witnessing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just as you're talking, just one other little thought I'll throw in there, because I've talked about this, turning fear into focus. I mean, technically, you actually still need that that fear generator. Because you need that central point of that fear, and because you have self-mastery, you're going to immediately strip away the emotions that are wrapped around that point, and you're just going to use the point. Oh, okay, my attention is focused. Okay, but I don't have an emotional response. Right? So you need something to generate that point still. And you're just going to strip off the emotions.
The anxiety.
Whatever. Yeah, and all of the froth that's such a vivid point in your mind is scary. And see, I mean, it literally is that. I mean, that's why we like to bliss out, in unity, because you eliminate all the points, and it's blissful. But as soon as there's this point in your mind, it's scary to us. That's the animal. Animal just responds to a point with fear.
That goes away in the mansion worlds?
In the mansion worlds, you don't have that generator anymore.
Nice.
Yeah. But see, you can self-generate focus. Yeah. I mean, I was telling people here just a little bit ago before class, see, that's the beautiful thing when you don't serve two masters anymore. Here, Jesus can erase something that's coming from, say, his mom's genetic nature, but it immediately is regenerated. You know, even during his public ministry, you know, post-baptism and everything. I mean, he can erase something, but it regenerates. When you get to the first mansion world, if you erase something, it stays erased. Because there's no second generator to regenerate it. So if you, when you finally erase, you know, some animal origin thing there, it stays erased. It never regenerates. Won't that be wonderful?
But here we have to work to keep the two perspectives functioning and keep the opportunity to understand them. Yeah. In real time.
Yeah. And like I said, you can see you can even understand why there's that fear thing and it doesn't go away, you know, when we're, say, relatively mature like we are relative to a million years ago. I mean, because you can't generate those focus points yourself yet. So they have to be generated for you. You just need to strip the emotion off and use the focus point. But on high, you can generate the focus point yourself. You don't have to see. It's like going from the four indispensables of early progressing civilization to the latter four. Right? Those cattle prod things of the, you know, slavery, war, social classes, and profit motive. I mean, you know, when you're more sophisticated, more mature, you don't need to be, you know, poked like that. You know, someone doesn't have to poke a sharp stick in my mind to make a focus point anymore. You know, it's like I can just bring my mind to a focus. But I don't have enough control over my mind yet to do that. I have just minimal encirclement in the Holy Spirit right now. But eventually, your first cosmic intuition, when it's more developed, it can just make a focus point, that logical acumen, right, the point of the word acumen, it can make the point itself. You don't need a sharp poker of fear to make the point in your mind.
Making the fear the focus point, is that called courage?
Courage is built upon the foundation of focus, yes. Yeah, but it's not, they're not synonyms.
No, they're not synonyms but it's, at all.
But if you think in a mastered, in the levels of a mastered self, courage sits upon a foundation of focus.
So those two master ideas, that's going to persist in the advanced aspects?
Yeah. We're a world, you know, in seventh stage light and life, still perforce serves two masters, the mortals there, yeah.
But you'll be far more mastered.
Yeah. Right. But and remember, the genetics is way, you know, engineered, right? So that other, material generator is a lot fancier than it is now. Yeah. Okay, let's see here. We read the Savage Visualizers, didn't we? I keep losing my place here. Let's keep going here.
Human prosperity was supposed to be especially provocative of the envy of the evil spirits, and their method of retaliation was to strike back through a human agency and by the technique of the evil eye. That phase of the cult, which had to do with spirit avoidance, was much concerned with the machinations of the evil eye. The fear of it became almost worldwide. Pretty women were veiled to protect them from the evil eye. Subsequently, many women who desired to be considered beautiful adopted this practice. Because of this fear of bad spirits, children were seldom allowed out after dark, and the early prayers always included the petition, "Deliver us from the evil eye."
Let's see, so the Lord's Prayer just morphs that, see? Right? And, you know, I told you we would be getting to the kids, you know, out at night. Yeah, there it is. Eugene, you know, when you brought that up earlier. Now, the thing that you may not appreciate that we should stress here is, see, notice how they're tying envy to evil eye. Okay, the word envy literally means, if you take it back to the, you know, the Latin word that it's coming from, the literalness of that Latin word is the literalness of, you know, of the concept of the evil eye, that looking askance at. Okay, that's the literal meaning of the word, is that you're looking at someone in that evil eye way. That's what the word envy means. Okay, so, you know, they're inescapably the same, you know, and an old translation of the Bible will talk about the evil eye, and a new translation will say envy, for instance. Okay, all right, so that's the whole point, is that this envy is being quote-unquote channeled, sort of, see through a human, and they're looking, and that envy, you know, is not their, you know, the human's envy, it's the spirit's envy that's being channeled through the individual. But of course, we mentioned before about projection. Whoa, how about this projection? I mean, this is so obviously, the whole evil eye thing is just projection. Humans are, are envious. You know, there's a reason why you have thou shalt not covet, right? In the Ten Commandments. This is just pure projection. It's like, I'm envious, so therefore the spirits are envious, you know, but I'm a good person, so my envy isn't really my envy. This is the spirit envy being channeled through me, and I'm giving you the evil eye in their name. I mean, it's all just this elaborate scheme, see? And for some to just deflect them getting a hold of themselves.
Right? Because I'm innately good. This becomes moralistic.
Yeah, see. Yeah. You can see how compelling this could be. Yep.
So culturally, if you were, if you made a bunch of money and things were apparently going well for you, and others might envy you, that could be a really bad thing culturally in societies like this.
Yeah, so that's exactly where we're going here.
Yep. You would want to hide that,
mm-hmm.
or you wouldn't want to be productive.
Yeah. Don't say it all, because we're going to read that. That's actually coming up. That's exactly. See, you logically know where humans went with this.
My brother-in-law encountered that when he created that thing over in Africa, and that he couldn't get anybody to take the wonderful invention and use it, because no one wanted to be that productive.
To have the evil eye fall upon them.
And make money and all that stuff.
Yep.
I mean, it was uncool.
Yep. You'll see we're gonna get that here in just a second. Yep. So this was huge, like they're saying. This is like all encompassing again. There's certain ideas are so vivid. It's just, they're universal and very enduring. Okay.
The Quran contains a whole chapter devoted to the evil eye and magic spells, and the Jews fully believed in them. The whole phallic cult grew up as a defense against the evil eye. The organs of reproduction were thought to be the only fetish which could render it powerless. The evil eye gave origin to the first superstitions respecting prenatal marking of children, maternal impressions, and the cult was at one time well-nigh universal.
Yeah, like I said, well-nigh universal. I told you we'd get to the phallic cult when we were talking about skyscrapers. but again, it's like, okay, so why did they have this superstition? Because, again, remember, the more foundational the energy that gets projected into some spirit scheme, the more powerful, right? And so, you know, when you set aside food hunger, what's the, you know, the next most powerful hunger, right? It's sex hunger. And so that's you know, powerful mojo. You know, and they have such a, you know, an intense fear of this whole evil eye thing. They've got to dig deep into the heavy duty mojo to combat it. Okay. Yeah, it seemed like I was telling you. I mean, there's all the evil eye stuff was everywhere. In the Jewish people, and so that feeds right into the apostles and the way they said things in the New Testament, because it's all predicated on the Old Testament. All right.
Envy is a deep-seated human trait. Therefore, did primitive man ascribe it to his early gods. And since man had once practiced deception upon the ghosts, he soon began to deceive the spirits, said he. If the spirits are jealous of our beauty and prosperity, we will disfigure ourselves and speak lightly of our success. Early humility was not, therefore, the abasement of ego, but rather an attempt to foil and deceive the envious spirits.
So, right, humble is one of those basic favorable conditions, and humans began to impose it upon themselves for completely ridiculous reasons, but nonetheless, they started to apply a favorable condition of humility. And see, like I told you, Katie, they were just about to get to this. And like I said, see, envy is a deep-seated human trait. Therefore, it's projection. Right? It's just that's how all of this bottom-up stuff is generated, is projection. And that has positives and negatives. Like I said, I mean, the fact that there's an internal sense of verticalness, you project that out into the ghost cult scheme. You know, but you project all the other stuff out, you know, out into it too. So again, you know, to try to actually get to a worldview that isn't a projected worldview—that's the challenge, right? And it's deep and sweeping to clean this all out of the way. It's not just God concepts and things like that. I mean, take something very foundational, something that we project and think is real. We think time is real. No, time is an appearance.
And but you better not be late.
Time, right? Sure, right. But again, doesn't mean there isn't sequence. Okay, I'm not saying there isn't sequence. Sequence isn't real, but the abstraction of time is not real. That abstraction is in your mind, and you're projecting it out there, thinking it's out there in reality, and that everything is ruled by it. See, that's just like this thing, right? To set up a physics that's based upon projection like that is no better than setting up a religion that's based upon projection of envy or something. It's the exact same thing. It's a false science. It's a false religion.
And a false humility.
Yeah. And sure, that it gets us started, but at some point, if you're going to make progress in going further with physics, you have to stop assuming that time is a reality.
Okay. But space is measured by time.
Well, we won't get into the physics of this stuff, right? But it's But
did you ever unpack who the he was who did that quote?
That's just but that's just a generic he.
Okay.
Yeah. Said that said one back then, right? And see, that's so obviously where this is going to go. And they're going to, a primitive person is going to take this very, very crudely and directly. you know, we will disfigure ourselves, you know, and stuff. I mean, it's going to be really grotesque, right, in its initial expressions. But it's not going to go away. It's just going to get more and more refined, you know. So, you know, we've got one more. Let's read one more paragraph here. That last part we want to save for next time.
The method adopted to prevent the spirits from becoming jealous of human prosperity was to heap vituperation upon some lucky or much-loved thing or person. The custom of depreciating complimentary remarks regarding oneself or family had its origin in this way, and it eventually evolved into civilized modesty, restraint, and courtesy. In keeping with the same motive, it became the fashion to look ugly. Beauty aroused the envy of spirits. It betokened sinful human pride. The savage sought for an ugly name. This feature of the cult was a great handicap to the advancement of art, and it long kept the world somber and ugly.
But at least
they were safe.
At least the insurance policy was in place. All right, so you know, so again, you've got all of this, all of these things that come into play in spite of ourselves. You know, we've got humility, modesty, restraint, courtesy. Yeah, and so, you know, it should remind you, okay, if you are ready to do what I've been saying tonight, I'm just going to completely separate myself from the ghost cult. I want to find the real God. Okay, well, recognize you have to generate within yourself the things that that ghost cult and all its schemes were generating in you, like maybe courtesy. That's going to have to be, you're going to have to be the author of it now. See, so if you're going to take this step, all these things where we behave in spite of ourselves, you know, if you will, you have to just do of your own free will. So it's, and see, the degree to which the enlightened, you know, being in the wake of the Enlightenment has caused a lot of humans to just toss out superstition. Yeah, but see, the baby goes out with the bathwater, like they're pointing out here. You know, so should we be surprised if humility and modesty and restraint and courtesy disappear? No, they can't do anything but. You know, because all you've done is the first step of throwing out the old. You haven't, you know, taken the personal responsibility and exercised the self-control to not do it within yourself. Yeah, it's just like if you take away the king and his absolute authority, right, and establish a democracy, okay, well, now you've got to do what the king was doing to you, to yourself. You can't think, oh, I don't have to have any constraints anymore. No, you have to impose those constraints upon yourself. Because if you don't, there's anarchy. Yeah. But we see, we got the first step, but we're totally oblivious, it seems, in general about the second step, right? And so you have, you know, just like they said, you know, in the wake of the rebellion, false liberty is a very, very problematic thing. And, you know, and it's getting more and more so where, you know, you just think you have infinite rights. I can just behave and I don't have to be courteous. I am. Right? And so, I mean, all of the civility is breaking down. See, I mean, you're going to lose your civilization. It's going to be, at best, a culture. Again, you're not going to be civilized. You know, you notice that so many things that we were reading tonight immediately take us away from religion, you know, and speak to the political environment or, you know, the general social environment, because you know, they're reminding you that even if it's a primitive, highly superstitious religion, it's nonetheless a nucleus for a civilized construct. Well, you can't take that civilized contract very far if it's a, you know, if it's a very limited religious nucleus, but it nonetheless nucleates. And so if you toss out religion, because, well, it's just nothing but superstition, and you toss out philosophy, well, because it's just nothing but opinion, yeah, then you're going to lose everything.
You just got nothing.
Right, yeah. It just, yeah.
Nothing but.
There isn't going to be anything remotely civilized about anyone or anything anymore in very short order. And that's the civilizational emergency that we're, why the book is here. See, so it's important that they lay all this out, you know, it's like, and point that out to you. You know how courtesy used to just kind of just be there? Did you ever think about why? And then why it isn't there anymore? That's what I'm trying to see. So they're trying to get you to think about the physics of society and how this stuff works, and just what an incredible responsibility everyone has to assume if we toss out superstition as a nucleating and a managing influence, like they're pointing out. I mean, this whole elaborate illusory scheme is governing almost everything that everyone does in society. It's why everyone does what they do. Okay? It has been for ages. You throw that all out and you just, everything is just going to completely lose its sense of direction. Okay? Yeah, and if you're not going to believe that literally knocking on wood does something, you know, well, then what? Or you know, just to take it to a very intense personal point, if you're not going to believe that your prayer can coerce the angels to help you out, well, then how are you going to conduct your life? How are you going to reorganize the way you behave and what you do? These things have been the organizing principles of mankind for a very long time. You know, and if you can toss them out, but it says sweeping consequences. Will you go catatonic with fear if you no longer believe that you can coerce angels to help you out with your material project? et cetera. You get the point. I mean, there's just sort of no end to the individual and the societal ramifications of tossing out superstitions and not replacing them with something as equally controlling.
How's that going to be vivid?
These things are all very vivid. I mean, the fear is just, makes a lot of this stuff vivid. All right, so like I said, you see there's a large paragraph break here. It's a great place to stop because we want to spend a lot of time on the remainder. This is the other key thing that we're building up to. We have important concepts that we speak of all the time, like duty and righteousness and truth. And it should be obvious to you now, I bet you all those things are false definitions because they're all defined in the ghost cult system. So if I'm going to understand what the word truth or what the word righteousness means in the Urantia book, I've got to get out of the ghost cult. I can't go to the dictionary. The dictionary has the ghost cult definition of the word truth. It has the ghost cult definition of the word righteousness. What do the revelators mean by these things? How do I get there? What am I looking for? What is truth? Yes, quid est veritas, what is truth? Yes. Pilate's greatest gift to mankind. It's one of the greatest things that's ever been said. Say what you want about Pontius Pilate, but
he tried to let him off 5 or 6 times.
That was a magnificent statement. All right, but we'll get to that. That's You know, you wouldn't expect to find such an important thing to the entire revelation in the ghost cults paper, but it's right here.
Everybody remembers what Pilate said, but no one remembers what Jesus said just prior to that.
Which kind of makes my point. Let's end it so it doesn't get too late here. But that just kind of makes my point about how significant, you know, everyone, you know, remembers that. I mean, a well-written dictionary will quote Pontius Pilate in the entry for the word truth. Okay. Anyway, let's we'll get to that next time. Let's take a moment here, everyone.